Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Tyler Novak.
And I'm Eric Newton. First up, we'll hear from Luke Stoddard Nathan all about the latest happenings in Troy.
And then our very own Elizabeth Press sits down with Troy City Council President Carmela Mantello to discuss her re-election campaign.
Afterwards, Julia Kavicki is here once again to discuss her fascinating eel research.
And later on, we'll have Justin Baker, who is in Selkirk this week, to interview painter Matt Tiernan. Let's start off the show with some headlines.
Advocates for the Medical Aid in Dying Act rallied in the state capitol on Tuesday. Also known as physician-assisted suicide, the bill has the support of Governor Cuomo, legislators, and increasingly medical providers, although passage is expected to take a few more years. In March, New Jersey became the eighth state to pass such a law after 7 years of debate. According to the New York Times, the Times Union, the bill would allow terminally ill adults with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live to administer life-ending medication prescribed by their physician.
Governor Andrew Cuomo has announced over $22 million in funding to aid two transformational projects in downtown Albany, along with others in Waterville, Troy, and Cohoes. The governor also has announced that $7.3 million from the Capital Region's Upstart Revitalization Initiative Fund has been allocated to the Capital District Transit Authority to begin its bus rapid transit line.
Governor Cuomo has also signed legislation allowing judges to reduce prison sentences for victims of domestic abuse who committed crimes while defending themselves against their abusers. The bill allows judges to change a sentence from incarceration to community-based programs considered more effective in rehabilitating survivors.
The Times Union reports that homeowners in Albany's Buckingham Lake neighborhood are increasingly opposed to a fifth-generation or 5G cell phone network. Stop Albany 5G are calling for a citywide moratorium on 5G infrastructure until the health impacts have been studied and reviewed. Professor David Carpenter, an environmental health sciences professor at UAlbany, supports this approach. However, a 1996 federal law blocks local governments from stopping cell towers because of possible health effects. Verizon is hoping to deploy 5G technology in 22 cities as part of an aggressive timetable to build a nationwide 5G network. The Syracuse Common Council recently delayed a vote on a deal to install 5G antennas on 600 citywide light poles over the next 6 years, over concerns about health and safety, labor, and federal policies. Meanwhile, the New York Times has run a story Sunday that suggests a Russian conspiracy to oppose 5G systems.
State lawyers have asked for a legal probe into the pension funds of St. Clair's Hospital in Schenectady. In February, more than 1,100 former workers at St. Clair's got a 30% pension cut or lost their pension completely, depending on when they retired. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram, Twitter, at Media Sanctuary, and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
And once again, we have Luke Stoddard Nathan in the studio for a Collar City News Update. Thanks for joining us, Luke.
Hey, good to be back. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. Last week in Troy Letter, on Friday, I detailed what is likely going to be in the city's fourth proposal to try to win the Downtown Revitalization Initiative. This is, for people who aren't familiar, a Governor Cuomo initiative that awards $10 million to a city's downtown for various private and public projects. Cities compete in regions to win this big grant. So the city of Troy will compete with other cities in Warren, Washington, Saratoga, Schenectady, Rensselaer, Albany, Greene, and Columbia counties. So quite a few. Albany won it last year. They're now kind of embarking on the, after you win, you have to embark on this sort of long planning phase as well. So the list of projects that I'm about to run down here are by no means like if Troy were to win, they wouldn't necessarily be like the final ones that would get the money, but it is at least an indication of what the city administration kind of feels like are the projects that deserve funding. Just a couple that stuck out. I included the full list that was on the sheet that was passed around at the meeting last week in Troy Letter. But I should say, too, the broad kind of vision of the plan that the city is including in its proposal is sort of a waterfront kind of centric plan that sort of stretches from the waterfront up by the Hoosick Street Bridge all the way down to Division Street. So all along the waterfront and some pretty big, you know, potential public investments in like public space and, you know, stuff around like Riverfront Park. One private project that I hadn't seen really discussed before or I hadn't really heard about it, at least in a while, is a project called the Dockside Project, which would be at two buildings sort of a few doors south of One Monument Square, that the two buildings that the Judge Development Corporation owns, which would be converted. They're calling it the Dockside Project into 26 apartments, four retail spaces, and then 20 basement parking spaces. These are sort of, if you ever walk down what's called Lower River Street and look on the east side, or sorry, the west side of the street, you'll notice like some old dilapidated sort of lawyer's offices that would be the Dockside Project. A renovation of the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, facade improvements for the Art Center of the Capital Region. That's a number of buildings, again, on River Street. The Trojan Hotel, you might remember that was the site of a Irish pub. I can't remember the name of it. O'Brien's Pub. Mm-hmm. But that closed, I think, last year. And then it was bought at a foreclosure auction. And I guess that's slated to become a boutique hotel sometime in the future. And money for One Monument Square, which at the presentation last week, the city's IDA chair described as sort of the centerpiece of the city's proposal as One Monument Square. Just to recap for folks, One Monument Square is a piece of city-owned real estate in downtown Troy that was the site of City Hall. It was demolished like a decade ago. There have been a number of proposals to build, you know, there in the past, but all of them have fallen apart for one reason or another. The city just recently put out an RFP after a kind of public workshop where they solicited input for what should go at the site. They arrived at a concept that involves both public and private interests, basically a public parking deck below with some sort of public plaza on top, and then privately owned buildings or kind of around it, maybe a restaurant there, maybe some other office buildings or residential space. And so the city put out an RFQ, a request for qualifications from developers, and they got four responses back. And they haven't yet picked which of the development teams will get to, you know, develop that real estate. But, and this was another item in Troy Letter last week, the city is putting together the committee that will choose which development team will win. And there's... I had a little bit of details in Troy Letter about this, but I had been asking the planning commissioner for a while and kept bugging him last week to try to find out the names of the people who are going to be on this committee to choose the real estate developer. He gave me on Tuesday, last Tuesday, four of the six names on the committee, but he wouldn't say who the other two were for reasons that weren't really clear to me, and I still don't know. The city, as far as I'm aware, unless it happened once we went on the air, hasn't yet announced who's on this committee. But he told me four names, and one of them was him, Steve Streichman, the city's planning commissioner, Dylan Turek, the city's economic development coordinator, Katie Hammond, who's the executive director of the downtown Troy Business Improvement District, and for Heidi Knobloch, she owns the Plum Oyster Bar and is also the board chair of the Troy IDA, CRC, and LDC, the city's like affiliated economic development entities. No real surprises there.
Exactly, you'd expect.
Those are familiar names. But the other two, I was told one is a architect and one is a landscape architect and engineer. But Streichman would only tell me that the sort of job descriptions of them, but wouldn't say actually who they were. So I guess stay tuned. You know, I would say though that considering that, you know, how much time has gone by since that, as that site has been vacant, you know, there's definitely some, you know, public interest in seeing this project progress quickly. So, you know, time's waiting. So I guess we'll see.
Do you hear from readers a lot about skepticism? Because I see it on the Troy subreddit a lot. There's a lot of skepticism that anything will ever be built there.
I mean, I would say that skepticism has been is borne out, right? I mean, there's reason to be skeptical. I haven't heard directly from readers lately, just because this has been so ongoing in public for a while. But you know, yeah, you see it on the Reddit discussion, you know, and it's a complicated site, and there the what's proposed now or what's contemplated at least in the request for qualifications is some sort of pretty complex like public-private partnership that would involve like the city owning the garage below the buildings, but maybe the developer owning the buildings above it, or some sort of long-term lease, maybe involving the local development corporation to kind of facilitate the deal. So there's a lot that could go wrong. And if you recall sort of the reason that the movie theater, which was the most recent proposal before this one, the reason that deal fell apart really was because a neighboring property owner, Sam Judge, whose Judge Development Corporation owns the properties immediately north and on both sides of the Monument Square, he sued, raising a number of claims, and that sort of prompted the deal to fall apart. So he, because he owns land on both sides, maybe it'd be a stretch to say that he holds a veto over whatever happens there, but he certainly has a lot of influence. Mm-hmm. You know, so that is something to watch too, you know. In other words, there's a lot that could go wrong, so there's reason to, you know, not be like, oh well, soon as they choose a developer, it's not as if like mm-hmm. the struggle ends there, you know. I included in the Troy letter last week also a roundup of the Land Bank, which I like to keep tabs on. This is a nonprofit that's sort of been endowed by the state through bank settlement funds to acquire dilapidated properties and either completely redevelop them or just stabilize them or demolish them and then eventually transfer them into the hands of homeowners with an eye toward not just selling them to the quote unquote highest bidder or just someone who's out to make a buck, but with the goal of kind of promoting neighborhood stability. And I should say they sort of focus mostly on North Central, or at least they have to date. They are selling once a big brick building that was then demolished. So now it's just a vacant lot not far from here on 7th Avenue. That's 3235 7th Avenue to Paul Paluwado, who is a mason who owns a number of properties throughout the city. He's going to build a new building at that site, which will include 4 apartments and storefront space. The board is going to meet this week in a special meeting because they hadn't yet awarded bids or opened bids yet, rather, for the 791 River, which is a building they're going to demolish and redevelop also as new construction. And lastly, the board is trying to complete a deal to accept a donation of 3325 6th Avenue. That is very close to here. Mm-hmm. A vacant two-story building in North Central. They're going to accept that building as a donation from Ocwen Financial Corporation, which is a mortgage servicing company. Ocwen is also going to give the land bank, if the deal closes, $75,000 to stabilize the building. There's a long, complicated backstory that, full disclosure, includes Executive Director of Media Alliance, Steve Pierce, in this story. He was one of the people who kind of helped advocate for this building not to be torn down and to be saved. Mm-hmm. So you can read all about that, how that deal kind of came together in Troy Letter. But it seems like a pretty big win for the land bank, not only get a donation of a building that would otherwise have been torn down, but to then get money from the bank or the servicing company, which, you know, is kind of closely related to a bank, get money from them as all also to help stabilize the building, which I gather is in pretty bad shape, but not terrible shape. It's in salvageable shape.
which sort of brings us to the NEF Center since we have a few minutes.
Yes. Though. What fun is media if you can't occasionally indulge in some kind of intrigue and speculation? The NEF Center is a giant athletic facility that's just south of the Post and Kill on Canal Ave, sort of on the cusp of South Troy, or depending, you know, the boundary of South Troy changes depending on who you talk to, but I'd call this sort of the beginning of South Troy, just south of the Post and Kill, or basically on the Post and Kill. It's this big athletic facility. It has like a baseball diamond as well, some parking. This is owned by the Sage Colleges, which I guess doesn't have much use for it anymore, or doesn't want it, or needs to sell it. It's listed at over $1 million. It has been listed since I think last summer. At a unrelated public meeting last week, the deputy mayor let it slip, or just said that the Community Builders, which is a nonprofit real estate developer that's working on an affordable housing project on the Post and Kill, not far from that, just a little bit west of there, that they're interested in buying the property, or sort of helping the Boys and Girls Club buy the property to use it as a Boys and Girls Club. And then separately, she said that she had heard that the school district is also interested in acquiring this property. I reached out to all those respective parties and also the listing agent, who said nothing to me about it. Just stay tuned, as you might expect. But and the city school district didn't get back to me either, but the Community Builders said that they're trying to get they're working with the state affordable housing agency to get funding both for their project, I guess, you know, Post and Kill Place, it's called. I've talked about it on the show and written about it before. It's a, you know, pretty big apartment complex right on the Post and Kill that's proposed, that's already approved by the planning board, but it still is trying to get, you know, other funding together for the project. They would try to get the funding would be in conjunction with from the state agency for that project, and then also for the NEF Center, you know, basically. That's what they told me on the record. So there's that. We'll see how that shakes out. I don't know what's going on with the school district at all, in terms of the interest in that property, but in other words, at least, you know, it seems to make sense, both of those, you know, potential buyers, given that, you know, that space seems to kind of fit an institutional sort of use. I'd also say this just occurred to me. This isn't something that, or maybe someone mentioned it to me, this isn't anything that I've heard, but, you know, the county is currently looking for a new senior center, a Troy area senior center, for because they're moving out of that building on downtown, on 3rd Street downtown. This would seem to be a potential fit. You know, there's big kind of multi-purpose spaces, there's parking, it's not like in totally downtown, so it's maybe a little more accessible, you know, for driving wise for seniors. So that could be an option. I wonder if the county will take a look at that.
You know, it might be a good deal for a city hall too.
Hey, always never a bad idea to bring up the fact that we're oddly enough tenants of our city hall. We rent our city hall space as a city, and you know, that seems non-optimal, to say the least. And sure, why not?
And if people want to stay up to date on everything that's going on in Troy, where should they go?
tinyletter.com/Troy_letter, or you can email me luke.s.nathan@gmail.com and just say, please sign me up for Troy Letter, and I will do so.
Thank you for joining us, Luke. That was Luke Nathan Stoddard of the Troy Letter. Next up, we have Troy City Council President Carmela Mantello talking about her reelection campaign.
Obviously, you're running for city council president again. I just thought we would take a moment for you to be able to explain to our listeners what you hope to accomplish with another term in this position.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, once again, thank you for inviting me on this really cool show. I like coming down here. I grew up black south of here. So I was born and raised here in North Central, and certainly those days it was much different. North Central was kind of a booming neighborhood, but the good news, it's really making a comeback. There's so many neighborhood associations, obviously, not just in North Central, but citywide, who are really stepping up to the plate, Elizabeth, to bring Troy back and to really revitalize our neighborhood. So why am I running for re-election? That's first and foremost. You know, I've seen some of our neighborhoods deteriorate. Lansingburg, I attended Lansingburg High. I walked the streets of Lansingburg when I was in high school. And right now, you know, if you have teenagers, it's a little frightful on some streets in Lansingburg. So we need to spread that momentum that's happening right now downtown. Downtown certainly is on a resurgence, and we need that momentum to spread to North Central, to the Burg, to South Troy. How do you do that? You focus on code enforcement. You focus on blighted buildings, buildings that are beyond repair. We need those buildings to come down before they fall down, which last week you saw Dowd in President Street, a building actually fall down. Public safety is a priority. They all domino into each other. And if we're going to attract new homeowners, if we're going to attract homeowners to invest in our neighborhoods, we need to ensure that our neighborhoods are safe, that they're clean, that they're not trash ridden. And so saying that from a council perspective, it's been a priority of mine for the last 3 years. It will continue being a priority over the next 2 years. So I'm very fortunate to be a council president, certainly being a Republican in a 3-to-1 Democrat city. Why do I get elected? I think it's because I'm independent. I separate policy and politics. Pretty much what we do on the council, 99% policy and maybe 1% politics. So I look at issues very independently and I focus on moving the city forward.
What can you say during that time that you have served that you're most proud of?
I'm most proud of our very first handicap swing. It's really near and dear to my heart. It's called the Think Differently initiative, and it's all about creating more accessibility and more inclusiveness for special needs, children and adults in that community. It's near and dear to my heart, Elizabeth. I have a younger son who has special needs, and I saw firsthand how businesses downtown and sidewalks just aren't accessible, how our neighborhood parks don't have handicap swing. So one of the first things I did 3 years ago was I partnered with the Epilepsy Association. We were able to raise our own funding, partner with the city, and we have our first handicap swing now. And we're focusing not just on handicap swings, but making our parks more accessible, making our city more inclusive. Think about it. The farmers market, it's really not accessible to people in wheelchairs, things to that nature. So the Think Differently campaign, more on a personal level, has been something I've been really, really proud to move forward. The administration is actually doing a survey with businesses and other neighborhoods and independent living association to really figure out how we can make our city more accessible and more inclusive. On a more major note, some other things is transparency and obviously financial. When the mayor and I took office, we were on the verge of bankruptcy. And certainly the mayor has different policies that he's tried to put forward. If you recall the 28% tax hike, I fought that. To me, we need to lessen the burden on our taxpayers. We need to ensure that the taxpayers aren't taking the majority of that burden. For instance, the garbage tax, I've fought vehemently against that. But more importantly, the transparency. So the mayor and I, even though we don't see eye to eye all the time, financial, our audits, we hired an outside auditor, the council, we put our money where our mouth is. There used to be a full-time paid auditor, $70,000 work for the council. We trimmed that to a part-time council, 15 grand now, no benefits. So those are just examples for the folks out there and the reporting. It's second to none now. We have an acting comptroller. He reports to the council. The council also, Elizabeth, you should know, when I came on board, was more of an arm to the mayor. We're independent, meaning we're separate. We're a legislative branch. The mayor's an executive branch. And I firmly believe that that separation of powers and just being the watchdog and being independent of the administration, because that's what we're paid for.
Great. Just one follow-up question. Mm-hmm. As a city taxpayer, mm-hmm. I'm just curious if you could just elaborate a little bit on the fees and taxes. And if we don't pay those, where will that money come from?
Yep. I would like to see more efforts in terms of the administration looking to partner with the county. If you recall, the Financial Restructuring Board is actually going to appropriate some monies to the city of Troy if we partner with the county more. There's low-hanging fruit, whether it be purchasing, whether it be IT. Other municipalities are doing it to lessen the burden on the taxpayers. This administration, I feel, has not explored those opportunities of sharing services, of consolidating services more. I used to oversee an agency, $70 million, 600 people, and I truly believe that the efficiency in the management of the City of Troy's agencies could be done more efficiently for the people of Troy. I will also tell you a public safety fee, not for the people of Troy, but to our larger institutions, whether it be RPI and our larger institutions. Other municipalities are doing that because if you think about it, our police and fire are sharing a lot of the burden to more development and to more students. This summer, we're going to see an influx of students that we haven't seen at RPI. Well, guess what? Public safety fee, and I'm talking $40-$50 that's tacked on to the students to go toward police and fire, solely toward police and fire, could certainly alleviate some of that burden.
So speaking of hot topics in the council, we've been following the resolution to propose to make or designate Troy a sanctuary city. This has been ongoing, and it's been tabled for a while. Rumor might say that it will be untabled this next coming meeting.
I'm not the sponsor of that resolution. My opponent is, but I have heard that the majority is looking to try to untable it. It was tabled, Elizabeth, back in December. First and foremost, I would like to see more neighborhood meetings, meaning there's been a couple neighborhood meetings, but they've been very focused and targeted. I'd like to see a couple more public meetings in the neighborhoods, but saying that, you know, if the majority's intent is to untable in June, I certainly, and I haven't to date done anything to stop that motion. And so saying that, you know, people are passionate on both sides of this issue. I oppose designating Troy a sanctuary city. I've said that from day one, and I'll tell you why. I've talked to a lot of folks. I'm talking a ton of folks. I do not base my opinion ever without input. And I also have talked to law enforcement. We know that law enforcement obviously is not keen on the idea. But more importantly, the people of Troy. Elizabeth, I've asked around. I have not heard of an instance where someone was treated unfairly by our police force. And I really look at it as an issue that everyone should be treated equally. And saying that, I have not been contacted by an individual where a police force has actually, you know, harassed that person to find out, are you an illegal immigrant or not? Saying all of that, I respect both sides of the issue. I respect and applaud the passion of the ICE Free and the folks from the sanctuary that are fighting to designate our city as a sanctuary city. I'm certainly one not to stand in the way if the majority is inclined to untable this and put it up for a vote.
And you said that in your legislative address as well. Just to follow up on that a little bit, you were just talking about supporting our differently abled communities.
Sure.
How do we show our immigrant community support if we don't put this label on our city?
Well, I don't view the folks who might not. Are you talking illegal immigrants or just immigrants in general? I mean, my dad came over on the boat, and certainly I would classify
him.
I
wouldn't call anyone really an illegal immigrant per se, but maybe if you're undocumented or documented, all of our, you know, We're a community where we have people from a lot of different places.
Sure. And I would say we're very, very welcoming. You know, a perfect example is we just opened the Vietnamese restaurant down on 3rd Street in Quang, I believe is his name. And, you know, that's a perfect example of someone, you know, who really worked very, very hard. And now he's opening a business
in Troy. I believe he's a refugee, actually.
Yes, here that's correct.
States. So, yeah, like, would he even be able to be here if, you know,
I'll tell you, Elizabeth, I see the issue as a federal issue. I know folks on the state and local level want to see more in terms of our government, and they're very upset about what's happening on a federal level. And I think it's really trickled down to issues here in the city that, quite frankly, I'm truly, you know, very, very intent on focusing on public safety. I'm focusing on making our city welcoming. And I think folks are so upset and just so anxious and so ticked off at the federal government that they're trying to really get their local communities to address an issue that can't be solved on a local level. The sheriff has said he's still going to bring ICE in. The police have to do their job. So whatever we do here in Troy, it really has to be addressed on a federal level.
I would love to continue this topic, but we are totally running out of time. Thank you for joining us here today, Carmela, on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Beautiful. Thank you.
That was WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press interviewing Troy City Council President Carmela Mantello.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Tyler Novak.
And I'm Eric Newton. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Finally, we get to our long-awaited eel segment. Julia Kavicki was in the studio discussing her research into the biology of the noble eel.
Okay, we're here in the studio this afternoon with Julia Kavicki again for part two of the eels. Welcome.
Hello.
Julia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. great
to have you here. So we had such a great time talking about eels last time that I really wanted to have you come back to continue this conversation. And I know that you've been doing counting of the eels, the ones that are coming up the Hudson River, and maybe you can remind us why they're coming here, and then what are some of your findings from what you've been looking at these past few weeks?
Yeah, so a brief recap of the great eel story is that these tiny little fish are born in the Sargasso Sea, which is kind of around where the Bermuda Triangle is. They say eel are the only thing that come out of the Bermuda Triangle alive, which may or may not be true. But they're born as these tiny, like, leaf-like kind of floating larvae, and they catch the Gulf Stream and come up along the coast of North America and head into tributaries from Florida all the way to Canada and grow into adult eels and live there for 15 years and then somehow remember to go back to the sea and swim down streams and go back to the Sargasso Sea and spawn and die, although no one's ever seen an eel die. So it may be that there are mortal eels in the Sargasso Sea somewhere. Nobody knows.
That's amazing.
So we've set up the DEC Hudson River Estuary Program has a project where they have people set up fike nets, which are these like big kind of mesh nets that you set up in the stream all up and down the Hudson River to try to catch these glass eels as they're coming in from the Gulf Stream. And glass eels are the kind of juvenile stage of the eel where they're about the size of your pinky finger and totally clear except for little red gills and hearts and digestive tracts that you can see kind of glowing in their clear little bodies. So we've got 13 nets set up and down the Hudson River, and we have one in the Post and Kill in Troy, which is right near the bridge on 1st Street between Ada Street and Canal Street. And we've got a net set up in the river there. It is still tidal even in the post and kill, so we check every day at low tide to see if we've caught any eels. And the eels migrate every night because they can travel under the cover of the darkness. So especially when there's no moon and there's clouds in the sky, there'll be lots of eels, presumably, and we've been looking for them in the water there.
That's amazing. Is that to avoid prey?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Apparently bats like to snack on baby eels, so they hide from... Well, I guess there the light doesn't matter because maybe the bats can echolocate for the eels. I don't know. But so we've been checking every day. Some of the streams, the Hanakoi Creek, which is south of Albany, has been catching many thousand glass eels every day. One day they got 16,900 glass eels in that net, which was incredible. And the volunteers count every single eel and then release them upstream. In the post and kill, we've been very patient. We've found 6 glass eels so far.
Whoa.
6 eels have made it all the way from the Sargasso Sea to Troy, which is the tip of where the Hudson River is tidal. And other than that, we've been finding lots of elvers, which are like 2 or 3 year old eels that have already been up here for a while. So one kind of theory about why maybe so many eels aren't making it up to Troy is this big road salt pile, which is right at the entrance of the post and kill.
Oh, right. It's right there in South Troy along the river.
Yeah. Folks might remember seeing as you're driving through that area, this big kind of massive white mountain looming by mm-hmm. the shore of the Hudson. And when the glass eels are coming up the river, they're kind of sniffing out the water to smell for fresher water and trying to swim away from salt water, which is in the ocean that they just left. But when they get to the mouth of the post and kill, they start tasting salt again and get a little confused and maybe start thinking, wait a minute, we went the wrong way. Turn around, everybody. And they don't come in.
Oh, wow. So we're creating havoc for their environment.
Yeah.
And sending them back the wrong way.
Yeah, the fish kind of get disoriented by the taste of urban urban runoff.
And this is from the salt that's blowing into the water, I presume?
Yeah, or flowing in when it rains or something, yeah.
That's tragic. Are there other environmental hazards that the eels face in the river?
Yeah, so eels are unique in that they're particularly fatty kind of fish, so whatever is in the environment is in the eel, and they can accumulate in London, actually, in the river. They've been testing eel for traces of pharmaceutical drugs and other illicit drugs, and it's actually found to be a bit of an issue with cocaine in eels. they have high levels of cocaine in rivers in London, and it's actually really disorienting the eels and confusing them about where to swim and doing all kinds of strange things to eel sociality. In the Hudson River, we have, of course, PCBs, which are particularly a problem for eels, and they bioaccumulate PCBs a lot more than other fish do. Mm. Fortunately, I think most fishers up and down the Hudson aren't as interested in eel as other fish, so maybe it's not so much of a problem. But there are some folks who've come from places like Cambodia or other places where they have a history of fishing for eel, and they do that in the Hudson and don't maybe know about this kind of history of contamination that the Hudson River has. So it's really important to communicate that story and to understand that, you know, what's in the river is in the fish and what's in the fish is in you if you eat it. So it's this kind of chemical connection that everything shares. And also kind of carries on between generations. So even as we're dredging PCBs from the river and I guess the EPA is kind of deliberating whether or not GE has done enough to do that, the PCBs remain in the fish, and it's an intergenerational problem where when Hudson River fish go to the Sargasso Sea and spawn new generations, all of those baby eels are now PCB eels.
Wow.
So it kind of becomes this much, much larger kind of seeping, creeping story about PCBs and not really knowing the extent to which this contaminant is traveling to other places.
Well, that's a significant story. What other stories do you know about eels that are like, you've been studying them for the past year or more, and do you have any kind of crazy stories about eels that maybe you want to share with us?
Oh, yeah. Well, one story that connects my past research project and my present one about combined sewer overflows and eel is eel in the sewer system actually used to be a major problem. Like, one of the number one things plumbers used to have to know to do about eels was, or a number one plumber skill was removing eel from pipes.
Whoa.
which happened for a number of reasons. One, eel somehow just really love getting into dark, kind of hideaway places, and pipes happen to be perfect eel habitat. Another aspect of that is glass eels start out really tiny and can get into tiny little holes or tiny little pipe openings. But once they get in the pipe, they would grow and grow and grow until they were the size of the pipe and stuck like how big do, or something.
How big do eels become ultimately?
Yeah, so the largest eel is probably about the size of your arm. So pinky finger to arm is embodied eel connection. So quite large and quite muscly. Yeah. So they used to be quite a problem, and plumbers had to know how to extract them. And they were also, especially in New York, there were a number of kind of plumber con men who would go around and say, "I've got a special filter for you to keep eels out of your water." And they would sneak in glass eels into the water faucet and then turn them on so that people would think they were glass eels
coming out of their water. That's a great trick. So this is a good way to get more money for the plumbers. Oh my God. So, what about stories of eels and other kind of habitats besides pipes?
Oh yeah. So eel not only wander between urban and natural waterways, but they also can go between land and water in a really strange and mysterious way, where there are tales of at night when the adult eels are migrating, they'll wander onto land to get around passages or just explore beyond their watery habitat. They're this strange kind of almost amphibious fish, where sometimes actually farmers would report that eel had wandered onto their fields and eaten, like, for example, eaten all of their peas or crunched on snails, and they would find, like, snail shells littered around their fields and blame the eels.
How do they get into a field? I mean, they're water creatures. What happens? I don't understand.
Yeah, well, they kind of carry some of their wateriness with them. They have this, like, really slimy mucus covering all over their bodies that allows them to move beyond
so they can go on the land with that.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And so they would sneak onto these fields, eat the peas, and then go back to the water?
Go back to the water. Supposedly. And there are also all kinds of other stories about at some point, I suppose they were dredging abandoned cars out of the Hudson River near the Troy Dam, and as they were pulling out the cars, there were like thousands and thousands of eels spilling out of these abandoned cars that they had found in the Hudson.
Oh my God!
So they kind of take up residence in all sorts of unexpected and strange structures.
Wow, these are such vivid images that you're giving us about the eels and what really lies beneath our waterways.
Yes.
So thank you so much. We're going to have to come back for part three, I think. But thanks so much, Julia.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That was Julia Kavicki keeping it slimy with her second installment of the Eel Discussions.
We now go to CollarWorks radio host Justin Baker, who recently had a sit-down interview with local artist Matt Tiernan.
Hey, this is CollarWorks Radio. I'm your host, Justin Baker. This week, I'll be featuring a new series of embedded interviews from Artist Studios. First up is Matt Tiernan. Matt is a painter, an abstract painter, part-time philosopher, and full-time musician. I sat with Matt in his home in Selkirk, New York, and we had a great time. Listen up. This is part one. Hey, Matt, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, thank you for having me here. For those listening, this week I'm embedded in Selkirk with Matt Tiernan. And we're going to talk about his work and hear what he's got going on. And in all honesty, I want to say that when I started this podcast, you were, or radio program, however you want to call it, you were the first guest I wanted to have on.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
I know I couldn't have done that because I needed to work up to this. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For those people who don't know your work, you're a painter, musician, shaman, maybe even.
Yes.
And we crossed paths a little bit in graduate school, so that's where I got to know your work.
Yep.
And I've been following you ever since on whatever platform they allow you on.
Yeah.
So your paintings have this kind of magical quality to them. There's abstract, but they reference so many things that I feel like that I'm interested in. You know, I think a lot of people are. So if you could start out, a couple of things we could talk about. I'd love to hear about a little bit about your process. What inspires you? How you get there? Also, maybe your work as a musician. Also, your father and mother, they were artists too. So we can go anywhere. But let's start off with... like how you get to the things that happen on the canvas or the paper or sometimes right. Yupo. Right.
Yeah, Yupo. That's a new favorite, yeah. Well, all right, so I have a condition called synesthesia. And for me, mostly it manifests with sound in various ways to varying degrees. In grad school... early in grad school, I suddenly decided to address that directly for the first time ever, really. I had made references to that, to these qualities, these visual qualities of sound playing in various permutations of metal bands and jazz rock bands and things like that. And it was generally met with violence. The drummer that I played with who we would get into fights anyway, but I wanted him to do a certain thing that had a quality that was like the sound in Purple Haze, which isn't purple to me, by the way. It's a completely different thing. It's a spatial thing. So I wanted him to create this space, and he took that very poorly. And so that was when I was 18, 19.
You grew up around here, right?
I was born in Wisconsin. I grew up mostly in Wayne County, New York, but we lived in Buffalo and the Finger Lakes. And the Finger Lakes opened my head. It was my first real contact with nature. You know, I mean, Buffalo was, you know, it was suburbs, but it was, this is Moravia, New York, near Ithaca and the Finger Lakes, and there were, you know, waterfalls in my backyard, and yeah, I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to live in the woods, and there was just this whole, the features of nature and the wildlife in it really, in particular, trout, these brook trout that were in the streams, really had an impact visually and psychologically. This like dark shale in the water. And then we moved to Wayne County, Pennsylvania, Shehawken, Pennsylvania. And that is where the obsession with sound, with guitar playing and music and sound related to the guitar, the electric guitar, that's when it really like hit home, and I you know obsessively played. But mostly, initially when it started, it was about just the sound, not necessarily the musical pitch or the arrangements or the you know the style. It was just mostly about the sound, and I really love distortion. I love the distorted guitar sound. It is cosmic, and George Harrison and Bangladesh Wah-Wah, for instance, that just, you know, melted my little skull. And soon after that, my father would play Bitches Brew, and that was really heavy because the sounds of this bass clarinet, Benny Maupin, I think, and then there were three keepers like Joe Zawinul, Chick Corea, and Herbie Hancock, I think, were playing, you know, all played at the same time. And so there was this crazy thing happening with the electric piano, and then this bass clarinet, like a giant king cobra crawling across the floor, right? And yeah, all of a sudden, you know, I remember it was evening. I think the sun was setting in the window. As a shag carpet rug, and I just remember. I remember.
You're listening.
I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking there are more dark corners here than there should be. Uh-huh. And it was my first obvious, you know, experience with synesthesia full on.
Right.
There have been other times since then, but that was the earliest I can recall. Mm-hmm. And so in grad school, I sort of hit a wall as to what I was going to do. In terms of not necessarily content, but as a way to get into these things, to get into this space, right? So, mm-hmm. I remember one day I just decided, well, I'm going to address that. So I started thinking about that and making work generally based upon those experiences. They're not the same. It's not an equivalency.
Right.
But then I started working with sound also at the same time I was making paintings and just making these sound collages and these abstract. Mm-hmm. I love ambient music. I love like sound treatments. I'm fascinated by sound design. Period. For obvious reasons. And so I started doing that myself, and the painting started happening exponentially, and I mean, super fast.
Were those collages informing the paintings?
So here's this is the difficulty. It what it's like is the paintings and the sound pieces, they exist independently of each other, and yet they have a quality where there is a discussion possibly between the two of them, but they dream about each other. They don't. One is not the other. They're not like I can't. I couldn't have a piece in a sound piece and a painting in the same room because I don't want that association to be made. Like there's people walk into a room like, oh, these two things go together, and they might not. The sound piece might be a little more related to a painting, you know, in my garage.
That
space, right?
So it's not like, look at the painting, put on headphones.
Right. No. I mean, feel free to do that.
Yeah. Sure.
You know? But no, that's not really my intention. As far as you know, if I have any intent, really, I just want to, you know, I want to get these things out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that goes for playing, you know, music, as it were, like organized music with instruments, as well as painting, and so that's how it started. And I also am really sort of unconsciously, I'm realizing unconsciously trying to remove as much of the obvious making of the thing as I can.
Like how you make it?
I mean, and you know, I didn't even
like
know
how a paint is applied.
Right, like how does this happen? And so
interesting.
So okay. there's like, and again, like I don't have a single shred of adherence to any sort of idea of process or, you know, punching in and making the work. And then it's not about the work. It's just about getting the clearest possible depiction of a manifold experience, which coincides with what synesthesia is, listening to, or, you know, music. There are things coexisting in space and in time that create a situation that I feel the need, and I'm sort of compelled to somehow put that forward in a painting or a drawing, you know.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to check out part 2 of my Matt Tiernan embedded interview next week. And as always, go check out Collar Works Gallery in Troy, New York, 621 River Street. New show opening up May 31st, Art Stands Still. It's a group exhibition about the freedom of movement.
That was painter Matt Tiernan talking with Justin Baker in his latest edition of Collar Works Radio.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Tyler Novak. Our engineer tonight was Cassidy McCabe. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.